From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The brackets are bending, and the first round is through. I'm not loving my picks. How about you? Ahead on Only a Game, a men's first-round update. Also, the University of Nebraska women's basketball team fixes to husk the Huskies in San Antone, maybe. And one duffer meshes the wisdom of Gandhi and Seve Ballesteros to attain the perfect golf swing. Also, bidding adieu to winter at the Intergalactic Winter Croquet Tournament.
We're the only winter croquet tournament that we know of, so we figured, okay, we can declare ownership of the entire universe. And I think we had a team one time that came in with spacesuits on and antenna, and we figured Intergalactic would fit.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Though Thursday's bracket action showed the underdogs were nervy, through yesterday the tournament was much less topsy-turvy, which is not to say all the favorites in men's NCAA basketball action woke up winners this morning, because Cornell, a 12 seed, knocked off number 5 Temple 78-65, and Georgia Tech, a 10, beat Oklahoma State, a 7, 64-59. Beyond that, Wofford, a 13 seed, came within 4 points of beating number 4 Wisconsin, and New Mexico State, a 12, fell just 3 points shy of Michigan State, a 3, 70-67. But the line held for such favorites as West Virginia, Purdue, Syracuse, Texas A&M, Pitt, and Duke. They'll all be moving on. The NCAA women's basketball tournament gets underway today. Because of Connecticut's domination, the tournament has been commonly referred to as the UConn Invitational, but there are other teams with big dreams of upsets, including Nebraska, which until last weekend was also undefeated this season. The Huskers are better known for their football history than hoops. Only a Game's Greg Eklund has the story on the emergence of women's college basketball in the Cornhusker State.
With 5 national championships in football, admission to a Huskers game at Memorial Stadium is still the toughest ticket around. After last season, the Huskers' NCAA record of consecutive sellouts, which started in 1962, is now at 304. By contrast, the Huskers' women's basketball team, now 30-1 and the number one seed in the Kansas City region, had its first ever home sellout last month against Missouri. Attendance has grown since mid-January when the Huskers defeated Baylor in Waco for a huge road win. Baylor, ranked 9th in the country at that time, was the preseason pick by the coaches to win the highly competitive Big 12 Conference. That caught the attention of Paul Clark of Gretna, Nebraska, and his 15-year-old daughter, Katie.
Need to?
Before that game, Clark had never attended a women's basketball game at Nebraska. When he did, he was amazed at the turnout.
God, when I was coming in here, I thought, geez, this is crazy. Leaves you a little in awe that this many people are coming to see the women, but I'm one of them.
In for the Huskers, number 23, Kelsey Griffin.
The Huskers' best player this year is Kelsey Griffin, a 6'2 senior forward who made an immediate impact with the Huskers as a freshman. She is the type of player that Huskers head coach Connie Yori dreams about.
She's rare. You don't get a Kelsey Griffin in your program every year. You know, I've coached now for, I believe this is my 24th year of coaching and 20 years of being a head coach. And, you know, clearly she's the best player I've ever coached. You know, she's an All-American. I've never coached an All-American. This is a first that I've had an opportunity to work with somebody who is not only so talented, but is so hardworking.
The Huskers became the first team in Big 12 history to finish the regular season undefeated. In the Big 12 tournament semifinals last weekend, Griffin spent more time on the bench than on the court because of foul trouble. It was a major factor in the Huskers' first loss of the season. Texas A&M, which went on to win the Big 12 tournament, beat the Huskers 80-70. Despite the setback, Griffin remained upbeat.
Well, if you'd have told me that we'd have been 30-1 at this point in the year, I'd have said you were crazy if you'd asked me that at the beginning of the year. So I'm still extremely excited with what we've been able to accomplish.
Oklahoma has lost to Connecticut and Nebraska this season. Sooners coach Sherry Cole won't say Nebraska is capable of beating UConn, but...
They share the basketball. They remind me a little bit of my 2002 team in the way that you don't look at them and go, oh, wow, how do you guard her? Yet Kelsey Griffin is unbelievable, and nobody's figured out how to guard her yet.
Cole's 2002 team reached the NCAA championship game, but they played against undefeated UConn, and, well, you could probably guess the outcome. This is the third time in the last four seasons the Huskers have earned a tournament berth, but with only one victory in the tournament under Connie Yori, that's expected to change. High expectations are nothing new around Lincoln, but for football, not basketball, it helps Yori to know that she works for an athletics director accustomed to dealing with that. The AD is the ex-head football coach and former U.S. Congressman Tom Osborne.
In the history of his football coaching career, there was no better coach in the country at running a program than Coach Osborne. And so I'm very thankful that I have a chance to work under someone who has been there, has done it, who understands coaching, who understands the ins and outs of working daily with your student athletes. So I'm very blessed to have that opportunity.
Osborne felt the women's team would have a good season this year, but even he's caught off guard by the Huskers' success, not only on the floor, but in the stands.
That's pretty special. And, of course, our volleyball team has had great support. The fans here are really, really outstanding. And, even if you're not winning, they're good. But when you're winning, they're great.
The Huskers will play their first round game in Minneapolis against Northern Iowa tomorrow evening. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Lincoln, Nebraska.
It's the first day of spring, and all those basketball games notwithstanding, that means it's time to talk baseball, which I very much enjoy doing from time to time with Tim Kirkchian of ESPN. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill. Thank you.
It's silly to draw too many conclusions from spring training performances, but the Detroit Tigers have to be encouraged by how well Dontrell Willis has been pitching. Not so long ago he was an all-star, but last year he was 1-4. The year before that he was 0-2. Will he make the Detroit rotation?
He has a chance, Bill, and I would have told you when spring training began that he had no chance because I didn't think this affliction that he has, that is the inability to throw strikes, I didn't think he was going to get over that. And apparently, so far at least, he has. Now, he told me this spring, he said, it's like I've been in quicksand for 2 years. He said, and when you get in quicksand, it only gets worse when you struggle and you try too hard. So he said, I may be in quicksand this year, but I'm going to have some fun this time. And I think he's relaxed himself to the point where he might be making a comeback.
Are there other individual performances during spring training that have caused you to feel either especially hopeful or particularly concerned?
Well, I think it's almost all hopeful because that's ultimately what spring training is about. Jason Hayward is a young outfielder for the Atlanta Braves, Bill. He's 20 years old. He's 6'6", 250 pounds. He's got the biggest pair of hands I think I've ever seen. And he had a home run so far this year in batting practice that he broke the sunroof of Bruce Mano, the assistant general manager for the Braves. And I can promise you that all good things are coming from Jason Hayward. Maybe not immediately this year, but at some point this year. The other guy is Steven Strasburg of the Washington Nationals. And I just got finished talking to a fellow, a veteran pitcher, who told me that he has never, ever seen a ball explode out of the hand of a pitcher like it does out of the hand of Steven Strasburg. He will not make the team coming out of spring training, but once he gets to the big leagues, my guess is June, you better watch out because something really special is headed the way of the Nationals.
The Angels, the Twins, the Dodgers, and the Cardinals were all division winners last season, and I guess if you agree with the old saw that baseball is 90% pitching, you have to like the Angels' chances again this year.
I do. I think they're going to win the division again, and yet another very popular website came out recently that, you know, breaks down baseball numbers and picked the Angels to finish last with 76 wins in their division. I said, you've got to to be kidding me. I just saw the Angels this week, and Mike Socha, I asked him, when was the last time you had five major league starting pitchers healthy for the start of the season? And he said, well, it's never happened here, and he's been there for 10 years. So the point is, their pitching is better than people think. It's not as good as it was last year, but it's still very good. And in a division that has two other contenders, Texas and Seattle, I still like the Angels because of the depth of their pitching.
Last year's other winners via the wild card were the Red Sox and the Colorado Rockies. Do you have any of the teams that didn't make the playoffs last year finding their way to that hallowed ground this time around?
Well, I think the one team that didn't make the playoffs last year that has a real chance to make it this year is the Chicago White Sox. Their starting pitching is potentially dominant with Jake Peavy there for an entire season. Their bullpen is filled with power arms. I really like their pitching. Now, they have to score enough runs, and I'm not sure they're going to do enough of that. But with the change in that division already this spring, Joe Nathan, the Twins closer, is hurt. That is a significant shift. I thought the Twins were the shoe-in to win the division. Now I'm not so sure. Now the White Sox and even the Tigers are right back in this thing. But and that's the beauty of that division, like the others. Very, very competitive.
Tim, Vin Scully, who was inducted into the broadcaster's wing of the Hall of Fame 20 years ago, is still broadcasting Dodgers games. He spent Thursday night in the hospital, though, after a fall. Please tell me he's fine and ready to get back on the air, because how can there be a baseball season without Vin Scully?
From what I'm told, Vin Scully will be fine, and that he will broadcast a game this weekend, which means everything must be okay. You know, Bill, seriously, all corniness aside, these broadcasters are a part of the family. They bring the game to you every night. They are the eyes and the ears, and there's never been any broadcaster in any city as revered and as influential as Vin Scully is with the Dodgers. And I can't imagine a Major League Baseball season starting without him, since we've played over 50 straight years with him at the mic. It's incredible.
All right, Tim, the time has come for you to go on record regarding who wins it all this time around. So, are the Yankees still the Yankees again?
Well, I know you're going to record this, Bill, and you're going to make a fool of me when the season is over. I know it, and I'm ready for it, and I never apologize for these picks. But I'm going to say the Yankees are going to play the Phillies in the World Series again this year for this reason. The Yankees are better than they were, and they also know that time is running out. As good as they are, they're getting older. Jorge Posada only has one more really good year left, and that may go for a couple other guys on their team. And the Phillies are better, too. And the Phillies, trust me on this, Bill, are really angry that they lost the World Series last year, and they're already talking about revenge. We don't just want to win the World Series. We want to beat the Yankees in the World Series next year. I think those two teams will play again in 2010.
And the winner is?
The winner is, I'm going to say the Phillies win it this time, because Roy Halladay is going to be an absolute dominant pitcher this year, and especially in the postseason.
Tim Kirkjian talks and writes about baseball for ESPN, and he joins me from time to time to do the same here on Only a Game. Thanks very much, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. So, a guy sells his blood to pay for his season's tickets to Green Bay Packers games. This would seem extreme, especially since the guy ends up selling 145 pints of his blood in order to attend Packers games for 56 years. But then the guy, whose name is Jim Becker, has a doctor who figures out that the reason Jim Becker's father died when he was only 43 was that his blood was retaining too much iron. It seems the only treatment for this rare condition, which is hereditary, is giving blood. A lot. So the Packers can thank Jim Becker for his loyalty, and Jim Becker, who is 79, can maybe thank the Packers for his longevity.
Give blood, but you may find the blood is not enough. Give blood, and there are some who say it's not.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Tiger and the Masters reunited, but does it feel so good? Also, a long and funny search for the mystic side of golf. But first, while March signals madness for basketball's college teams, it's also a sign that the NBA's race to the playoffs is in the home stretch. Joining us now is Kevin Hench, who writes about the NBA for FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill.
Cleveland leads the NBA in wins. In a three-team trade last month, the Cavs acquired Anton Jameson and traded Zydrunas Ilgauskas to Washington, but the big man could return to the Cavs as early as next week. Have Cleveland's midseason changes improved their hopes for a title?
All Cleveland has needed, really, for years now is a couple of options so that LeBron doesn't have to do it all by himself. And I think Anton Jameson is definitely a guy that can carry you for 6 to 8 minutes while LeBron gets a blow. I know I've been boring you with my Lakers, Lakers, Lakers mantra all year long, Bill. Well, get ready for me to change it up.
Oh, excellent.
Because I think the addition of Jameson and the way LeBron has been playing, I actually think the Cavs are going to win it all.
When Orlando added Vince Carter during the offseason, a lot of analysts said that he wasn't the right fit for the defending Eastern Conference champs, but Carter has been a source of steady offense, a key complement to center Dwight Howard. Does he help the Magic return to the finals?
Well, the big question, of course, that's the big hurdle for the Cavs, is to get over the Magic, who seem to have their number, but I don't know how it works in terms of chemistry, but for some reason, I think Vince in the playoffs will be a bit of a subtraction from Hedo Turkoglu, and I think the Cavs beat the Magic in the conference finals.
The Celtics, meanwhile, are battling the Atlanta Hawks for the third seed in the Eastern Conference. These two teams have developed a little bit of a rivalry over the last few years. Is this the season the Hawks surpass the Big Three and company?
Well, the Celtics are battling more than just the Hawks. They're battling osteoporosis. I mean, this team is like
what a cruel man you are.
The team is like the family dog where you're really wondering if its quality of life has diminished to the point where it's time to euthanize. It's so hard to watch the Celtics in this decline phase. Not only would the Hawks definitely beat the Celtics in a playoff series, but I think any Eastern Conference playoff team could potentially beat the Celtics. The Celtics have lost 10 games since Christmas in which they led by 10 or more points. That's not a team that can close out games.
The Bucks already have more wins than they had last season, and they're on a pace for their first winning season since 2002-2003. If the playoffs started today, Milwaukee would be the fifth seed in the East. How did this team buck its losing trend?
Well, Andrew Bogut quietly, I guess everything is quietly when it happens in Milwaukee, but Andrew Bogut quietly is a legitimate stud. He's second in the league in block shots. He's in the top five in rebounding, and he's just been outstanding all season. Brandon Jennings' revelation at point guard, and I think the John Salmons acquisition was a big deal for that team, and they're another team that could definitely beat the Celtics in the playoffs.
I'm beginning to sense a kind of theme running through this, Kevin. Let's go to the West, where the Lakers are leading the conference, and they look primed for a run at a second straight title. Any potential stumbling blocks in the West for Kobe at all?
The one thing, if I'm looking for an opening, a possibility that the Lakers will not be in the NBA Finals, I think the Dallas Mavericks really improved themselves when they acquired Brendan Haywood and Caron Butler. Because the one thing that the Lakers have, when they put Lamar Odom at the three and they play Bynum, Gasol, and Odom together, they're so long. But Haywood is a legit seven-footer who blocks shots and rebounds. Dirk's obviously seven-foot, presents some problems matchup-wise with his length. And Caron Butler, even though he's not a banger, he is 6'10", and the Mavs are suddenly a very big team, and Jason Kidd has gone to the fountain of youth. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but there is a sliver of a possibility that that team could beat the Lakers. And I do think if you're looking for inspiration and motivation, the Denver Nuggets definitely have something to play for now with their coach George Karl battling cancer. And I feel like those two teams would scare me if I were a Laker fan.
Right now, the Jazz would be the fourth seed in the Western Conference playoffs. Does Utah have any shot at going deep?
No, Utah is just, you know, sometimes this game does come down to length and size and just being taller than the other guy. And Boozer and Millsap and Okur, they just don't look very big when they play against the Lakers. Like, I just think those guys particularly match up poorly with the Laker front line.
In other basketball news, on Wednesday, the NBA approved Michael Jordan's purchase of the Charlotte Bobcats. Jordan is taking over a losing franchise and a franchise that's also losing money. Can he turn the team and his own subpar record as an executive around?
Well, I mean, I guess I go back to the Bill Parcells quote that I like to invoke, which is, you are what you are. And as a player, Michael Jordan was the greatest of all time. And as a, as an executive, I think he's proven that he's more interested in golf than watching game film of college players. So I would doubt that Michael Jordan at this point could become an effective front office man, maybe calling all the shots. He can prove me wrong. But I think Jordan was certainly better when he was taking the shots as opposed to calling the shots.
And Kevin, last but not least, well, actually, I guess it would be least, the New Jersey Nets have 14 games remaining. They need to win three of those 14 to avoid becoming the worst team ever. That distinction is held by the 1972-73 76ers, who won nine games. Will the Nets next rise above or fall below that lowly mark?
Well, sadly, for those of us who were predicting they would break the record back in October, I think they will win 10 games. breaks my heart to say so.
And there will be celebration throughout the Meadowlands.
The balloons will come down from the rafters when they go 10-72. Brook Lopez is a nice player. All is not completely bleak in New Jersey. I think they can, within 5 years, they could be up to 20 wins.
Kevin Hinch covers the NBA for FoxSports.com, and his new podcast with John Sally, Spider and the Henchman, is available on iTunes and on AdamCarolla.com. Kevin, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Golf's biggest story in some time, maybe ever, broke on Tuesday when Tiger Woods announced that he would resume his career at the Masters in Augusta on April 8th. The tournament, which is, of course, one of golf's majors, will certainly generate record attention, whether those who run the Masters like it or not. Imagine the disguises tabloid reporters and photographers will don to attempt to enter the hallowed grounds. Meanwhile, fans of the game will be wondering whether Woods can play his best golf after the four-month layoff, which followed his automobile accident in November and the subsequent revelations of his extramarital affairs. It's not true that there are as many books about how to improve your golf game as there are golfers. It is true that almost everyone who has played more than 18 holes of golf has tried to improve his or her game by reading something, practicing some form of exercise, visualizing hitting better shots, or altering consciousness according to the instruction of a guru. Josh Karp, whose new book is Straight Down the Middle, is no exception, and he joins me now from WVEZ in Chicago. Josh, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on the show, Bill.
The subtitle of Straight Down the Middle is Shivas Irons, Bagger Vance, and How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love My Golf Swing. For the sake of those unfamiliar with golf's mystic side, please tell us a little bit about Shivas Irons and Bagger Vance.
Shivas Irons is a mystical Scottish golf pro who is in the novel Golf in the Kingdom. Two of the best-selling golf books ever written are Golf in the Kingdom and Legend of Bagger Vance. And, you know, we like to think of golf as this kind of bland, suburban sport with plaid pants and Pat Summerall and the whole deal. And really, two of the best-selling golf books are based in Eastern spirituality. Bagger Vance is a kind of mystical caddy in Stephen Pressfield's book. What a lot of people, even those who've read it, don't know is Bagger Vance is almost a literal retelling of the Hindu story of the Bhagavad Gita. Bagger Vance is actually for Bhagavad. So there's a lot of golf mysticism out there, and it's, I think, a lot more widespread than most people would imagine.
Tell me a little bit about what you had to do in order to set up the journey that you went on, not only all over the United States, but to Scotland as well.
The whole idea for the book started out when I'd been meditating for a little while, and my wife took me to a meditation seminar in Chicago. And we go around the room to talk about how meditation has impacted our life. And I said, it took a couple strokes off my golf game. And everybody looks at me. You know, I don't know what's a blasphemous thing to say in Buddhism, but that was the look. And then the guy who's running the seminar says, oh, the Sakyung, who is the head of this organization, is an avid golfer. So my first thought was, okay, this is a great magazine article. And so it began with my pursuit of the Sakyung, which came to a somewhat ignominious end where I was put in touch with one of his golf partners who stopped answering my emails and my phone calls. And then I kind of went, well, my God, I'm borderline stalking not just a Buddhist spiritual figure, but also his golf partner. In the meantime, I started really just looking around to find all these different people. And then a lot of the people I worked with told me about other people who had interesting approaches.
All right. You contend quite early in Straight Down the Middle that, quote, the conscious mind is no place from which to play golf. Who first told you that when you swing a golf club, you shouldn't be thinking?
The first guy who I went to see was a guy named Yoni Zalewski, who has a place called Whole Body Golf in Denver, Colorado. And I was immediately ready to go see Yoni because his website kept saying effortless swing. And I like to, you know, think of myself as a guy who likes to do something with no effort whatsoever. Anything that involves no effort, I'm up for. So I went to see him. And he said, you know, he's like, God, most of us, you know, get over a ball. We're thinking 46 different things. We're thinking what we read in Golf Digest, what we saw on the Golf Channel, what the pro at our club told us to do. And most of golf instructional culture is built on swing thoughts. Pretty much everybody I saw said, you know, the best swing thought is no swing thought.
We're talking about getting into the zone and clearing your mind and all that. But the thing that really strikes me about golf is the way people go out and they break their clubs against trees and throw them into the water hazard. And then they claim, this is how I relax.
And, I mean, spend an enormous amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Golf is the one sport where people scream at themselves like that. And they expect to do well when they're doing that. And, you know, if you take an example from another sport, you know, Jordan missed over probably 1,000 free throws in his career. I'm a Bulls fan. Never once did I see him running back down the court going, Jordan, you idiot, you idiot. How could you do that?
Of all the approaches that you have heard about how to improve your golf game, can you point to one and say this is the best?
A woman I worked with in Encinitas, California, her name is Jamie Zimron, and she calls herself the golf sensei. She's like a fifth degree Aikido black belt, and she played professional golf briefly. She had me swing an Aikido sword on a driving range, like a golf club. And I wound up doing a lot of kind of, you know, weird things in public. I lost a lot of inhibitions throughout all this. But the purpose of
this... I guess so, swinging a sword on a driving range.
Oh, I held hands with other men on a driving range and meditated with them. I meditated in the middle of a restaurant with somebody. But one of the things in Aikido is that it's about the movement of energy. When you're hitting somebody, your energy should be at the point of contact. And most of us are gripping a golf club like we're trying to strangle it. The idea that, you know, you're really hitting, you know, the energy should be in the head of the club, which is something that takes a little bit of, you know, getting used to mentally and philosophically. But once I understood that, that really helped the way I swung the club. And also Les Boland, we went out and played golf without keeping score. And then I went home and tried to do it myself. And that was like a real experience. I mean, I was like a gambling addict sitting in the parking lot of the Majestic Star Casino, you know, with my card after the first hole. I had the card and the pencil and my hands were like shaking. And I was like, don't do it. Don't do it. But there's this kind of Buddhist idea that once you stop grasping for enlightenment, that's when you achieve enlightenment. And I think that is somewhat true of your golf score. Once you kind of let go of, I'm going to go out there and shoot an 80, it really, I think, frees you up, A, to enjoy the game, and B, play better.
I'm talking to Josh Karp, the author of Straight Down the Middle, and you're listening to Only a Game. In Chapter 10, you write, I had learned a trick you must do rather than try. But, Josh, I'm not sure that's entirely original. Listen to this.
Try not. Do. Or do not. There is no try.
You ripped off Yoda, didn't you?
In my own defense, I just am completely missing the sci-fi chip. So, like, I'm not, you know, I have no gene to be like, oh, wow, yeah, Star Trek, that's great.
You're saying you didn't rip off Yoda?
Well, perhaps Yoda is ripping off Buddhist golf theory. I'm not sure, but I'm sure I did not get it from Yoda, though I think, you know, perhaps it is a reflection of Yoda. But I seriously, consciously, when my kids watch these movies, I can barely sit in the room. I find science fiction so tedious. So,
all right. Now, just for the record, what was your handicap before you started this journey, and what's your handicap now?
Okay. Well, I was somewhat of an unwavering 18 for quite a while before I went to work on the book. I got down to about an 11. Last summer, I played more like a 12 or a 13. I didn't play a ton. So I, you know, like any golfer, I will eternally think of myself as an 11 because it's the best my handicap's ever been.
Based on your considerable experience with people determined to improve your golf game and your life, and I know some of these people told you that thinking was not a good idea, but can you give our golfing listeners one swing thought?
The one swing thought I would give you is people hold the club way too tight. You'll be surprised at how loose you can hold the club and how much it improves your shots. And that's something that's very counterintuitive because I think most of us, you know, really think we can power through things. It's kind of a, I guess, a Buddhist metaphor. You know, the more you can kind of let go of both swing thoughts and of your club without letting it fly out of your hands, I think the better your golf game. I think loosening up my grip on the club was actually a really profound change in my golf game.
Josh Karp is the author of Straight Down the Middle, Shivas Irons, Bagger Vance, and How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love My Golf Swing, published by Chronicle Books. He joined me from WBEZ in Chicago. Josh, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
I heard it ping down the middle. It went zing down the middle. Oh, the life of a golfer is not all gloom, though they charge you for listening in the locker room. But I'm in my glory when wrapped in a towel. I say that it went straight down the middle. Where it wound up is a riddle. But it went straight down the middle, far away.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
For almost 200 years, the Wits and Cheese Rolling has been an annual tradition. The event has encouraged generations of men and women to tumble down a steep hill in Great Britain's Cotswolds in pursuit of rolling wheels of double Gloucester cheese. A good time has generally been had by all, except for those sustaining injury, either because they have fallen or been pushed or been struck by the 7-pound cheese wheels, which have been known to achieve a speed of 70 miles an hour as they careen into the crowd of bystanders. But not this year. Because of the large and unruly crowd and the number of people creamed at last year's event, the Coopers Hill Cheese Rolling Committee has churned out the decision to slice their event out of Britain's sports culture. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Vermonters take croquet from galaxy to galaxy, as long as said galaxies are all in Vermont. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
There were multiple upsets and three overtime games on Thursday, the first day of the Men's College Hoops Tournament. That makes for exactly one more overtime game than was played in all of last year's big dance. Does this tournament continue on the wacky path established on day one?
Well, that was probably the best single day I think I can remember in this tournament. I mean, there was one a long ways back where, I think it was 1969, where they had two regional finals, came down to a last shot. Rick Mount hit one of them, and Charlie Scott hit another one. And then there was a day, maybe 15, 17 years later, where two games went down to the wire, and the defending champion got beat on a half-court shot. That was pretty interesting. But this was just this is just extraordinary. And it was a great day for basketball, and perhaps the worst day in my career. picking games. Not only is my bracket done like dinner in that Texas, whom I'm glad I didn't follow all season or they'd have killed me sometime in February, lost. My university lost.
Marquette.
And my team in the blind draw got beat on Friday. I'm watching this tournament purely, as they say, for amusement purposes only.
rendered such. All right, we'll move on from basketball to spare you.
Cornell, on the other hand. Right. Cornell!
Of course, the biggest sports story of the week was the announcement on Tuesday that Tiger Woods will play in the Masters, which begins on April 8th. No warm-up tournament for him. Good choice?
Who knows if it's a good choice for the world in general. It's probably the good choice for him. I'm surprised that the Masters wanted this this whole thing. But then again, I realized that the Masters is the one sports event on the calendar that completely dictates its own terms to everybody. So if he wanted to play his first tournament in a self-contained bubble, he found exactly the right place to do that.
How do they make that bubble even more self-contained than it has always been? Because they're going to have to do that this
time
around.
Rumor has it that they're going to arrange it that he plays his first round during the time when it's not on television. ESPN has a very carefully negotiated broadcast window on Thursday and Friday, and the rumor is that Tiger Woods' first round is going to be at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I guarantee you, he hasn't played a 7 o'clock tee time since he was 8 years old.
Charlie, according to reports this week, not only are National Hockey League general managers intent on changing the rules regarding blindside hits to the head, they want to enact the rule this season. Can the National Hockey League legislate their way to a less dangerous game?
I hope so. I mean, I never understood, at first what they were doing, because there was, we can't do anything to Matt Cook because of his hit on Mark Savard, because first they decided it wasn't really a cheap shot, which was nonsense, and then they decided there's some sort of ex post facto rule they didn't want to invoke. I would enact it tomorrow. I would enact it in time for tonight's games. But never underestimate the capacity of the NHL to do the wrong thing at the wrong time.
After the NHL GMs resolved to change the rules, it seems that some of the players resolved to get their violence in while they still could without penalty, or is that a fair statement?
Well, you got James Wisniewski from the Anaheim Ducks put Brett Seabrook of the Blackhawks out of a game. When he rammed his head into the glass with such force that he was just virtually out on his feet. This is one of those things on which I do not understand hockey. I love hockey. I love to watch it. I'm a very big promoter of it to my friends who are snobby against it. But this is just stupid. This is players being stupid. This is a league being blind. Sooner or later, the coaches have to get together and stop this nonsense.
Major League Soccer season is supposed to begin on Thursday night. How do you like the chances that it will, in fact, begin?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of grumbling. Owners are saying now, that, of course, that if you guys go out on strike, then there won't be a league. To be honest with you, I don't know. I mean, this is it doesn't seem like the players' union in the MLS is asking for anything outrageous, but it does seem like the MLS is using it. The management is using its own tenuous place in the American sports scene as a weapon. Which is, you can't strike us. We're too weak a league. Sounds counterproductive marketing wise.
There was news this week that Ron Washington, the manager of the Texas Rangers, had tested positive for cocaine use. Did you know that Major League Baseball even tested its managers?
I did not know that, and it's interesting. Of course, it's also wonderful that the results of this test managed to leak, thereby proving once
astonishing.
Again, proving once again that the confidentiality agreement signed by management with anybody they want a drug test aren't worth the paper they're printed on. Yeah, this is an interesting one. He's apologized. He's going to put the right dumb show on for all the drug warriors, and that'll be that. But I do think it puts him on shaky ground if the Rangers don't get the Rangers better get off to an 18-2 start.
He has asked to be tested three times a week from now on throughout the season.
I'm sure it'll liven things up.
There's been evidence in the past that the Giants and the Jets don't much like each other, Charlie, and each team wanted to open the season in the new Meadowlands Stadium in September. How did the National Football League deal with that spat?
By making a mess of it, pretty much. Woody Johnson, the owner of the Jets, was saying he suggested a coin toss is the fairest way to resolve the thing. The league told him not to, and then he says the league told him that, hey, we tossed a coin anyway, and you guys lost. Doesn't this strike you as the whole Guys and Dolls scene where they're playing with craps with dice with no spots?
The only thing better than a coin toss is a secret coin
exactly
toss.
Exactly right. You know what's terrible, though? Losing the secret coin toss.
And finally, in the name of updating stories, I remind you that the last time we discussed Gilbert Arenas of the Washington Wizards, it was in connection with four guns.
How many guns are we up to this week?
Well, I don't know, but he says he told Esquire that he should be punished for bringing the guns in the locker room because he wasn't using, quote, longevity thinking.
Yeah, it's true. Who can argue with that?
I would not use that either because I have no idea what that is. I think he meant long-term thinking, but I think longevity thinking is, you know, you're not thinking of your longevity if you're wandering around with a gun. Let's put it that way. You're certainly not thinking of someone else's longevity if you're wandering around with a gun.
And in Gilbert's case, the magic number is somewhere between 400 and 500 guns.
He said he used to have 500, having bought many of them from an elderly man's World War I gun collection, and he said he put all but four of them in storage when he started having children. Good for him, by the way. There's no reason why one of his kids should have two guns and the other one should have three.
Or 400.
You get an arms race going with the toddlers, and there's no telling what can happen.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Today is the first day of spring, which might not mean much to folks in warmer climates, but to the people of central Vermont, the beginning of spring marks the end of a long, cold winter. Every year, to celebrate the last weekend of winter, the small town of Waterbury, Vermont, stages the Intergalactic Winter Croquet Tournament. This year, Only a Game's Karen Given was there.
For an athletic event which claims to crown the best in the universe, the Intergalactic Winter Croquet Tournament is rather modest. 3 days before the first mallet crack, only five teams had signed up and the trophy had gone missing. But by 7:30 on Saturday morning, 14 teams have gathered in the Park Row Cafe in Waterbury to talk strategy over coffee and pancakes with real Vermont maple syrup.
How many of you people are here for winter croquet? Those of you who didn't raise your hands, we apologize.
Tom Beardsley is the general sales manager for WDEV, the local radio station which started this tournament as a promotion. Intergalactic Winter Croquet is loosely based on a game called Poison. After knocking their ball through a series of wickets, players must hunt down opposing teams until only the winner remains. At least a foot of snow and ice on Rusty Parker Park is considered optimal. But today is unseasonably warm, in the 40s, leaving only small patches of dirty, melting snow on the east side of the field.
When's the snowmaking start?
No, hey, the deal with winter croquet is that we take whatever conditions the good Lord delivers, and that's that. So stop complaining, John.
How are we going to hide the balls?
There will be no hiding your balls this year, John. Ann?
Beardsley says the tournament started as a gag in the early 80s as a way for Vermonters to break cabin fever. The name came later.
Yeah, well, we felt a few years ago that we're the only winter croquet tournament that we know of, so we figured, okay, we can declare ownership of the entire universe. And I think we had a team one time that came in with spacesuits on and antenna, and we figured they were from another galaxy, so we figured Intergalactic would fit.
Get a mallet, get a ball, and let's play croquet.
Actually, a quick check of Google shows that folks in Waterbury aren't the only ones playing croquet in the wintertime. As the tournament gets underway, I start my search for the intergalactic part of this intergalactic tournament. The first team I come across is headed by a guy named Skip.
Skip Flanders with a team from the Wesley United Methodist Church here in Waterbury.
So you're the first team I've talked to, and you are not, in fact, intergalactic. You are local.
Yes, we are local, but we work in God's world.
Which is intergalactic.
Starting from the east will be Curves 1, the sliders. Curves 1.
As Beardsley announces the first seven teams to take the field, a pattern becomes obvious. A team from the local gym will join the local gas company and the Waterbury Rotary Club on the eastern wicket. But at least one team, the Plain Folk, is doing its best to live up to the name of the tournament.
This is what you humans call a joke, correct?
Wearing long, multicolored bathrobes, hooded sweatshirts, and gray alien face masks, the Plain Folk certainly set themselves apart from the crowd. They agree to lift the masks and grant me an interview.
Jason Bonner.
And you are?
Carl James.
And you guys are from where?
France.
France.
No, from the village. We're village people.
The Plain Folk aren't any more forthcoming when I ask them to describe their outfits.
Well, this is Dolce & Gabbana. This is Chanel. What are you guys wearing to the party?
I'm wearing kimono.
Cashmere?
Yeah.
What are you wearing, Lydia?
I'm wearing, like, this... It's a nightgown. And I'm wearing this alien mask on my face.
Lydia is 9, and before taking off across the field to show me that she can do the moonwalk, she tells me that today was her first time playing croquet. Despite the obvious comedic value of a small girl moonwalking while dressed as an alien, no one seems to notice.
Come on, you can do it!
Not everyone who plays in the Intergalactic Winter Croquet Tournament is a good croquet player. In fact, skill isn't required to win. The Wacky Wickets proved that when they won a decade ago, despite being the worst team on the field. Wacky Wicket Sandy Urshow says that year was a rare loss for the Waterbury Fire Department.
They win more often than not, but they're sore losers when they don't win.
Kenny Ryan has been with the Waterbury Fire Department for 3 years, and he bristles at the idea that his team is less than sportsmanlike.
We might just be better, you know, more in shape, you know. I don't know what it is.
Mike Carey has been with the fire department a bit longer, and he knows how the team got its reputation.
I can remember, I want to say it was middle 90s. It was much more wintry, and we had a fire truck over here, and we lost, and we kind of like... sprayed some water. Some people got upset. Some people thought it was funny.
I think we should have done that today. We could have made some snow out here.
We could have right now.
Well, I see some alteration of the terrain going on down here. Is someone seeing alteration of the terrain?
No, not us.
Is that right?
What?
Altering the terrain.
Alterations?
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's okay. Carry on.
On the one patch of snow that hasn't melted, the firemen build a ramp to guide their ball through the last wicket. But it doesn't take long to discover the real secret of their success. Every time the official isn't looking, a fireman casually steps over the team's ball and taps it into a more favorable position. I mentioned this to Carl Ettnayer, a radio talk show host on WDEV and the co-official official for this tournament.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah, definitely, without a doubt. Every time one of them goes near it, they just kind of slide with their
feet. They can cheat as much as they want as long as they don't get caught. It's like a traffic infraction. If the police doesn't see it, then you as a citizen reporting it doesn't make it illegal.
Go for the fireman.
Yeah.
Before long, the first round is down to just a few teams, including the Waterbury Fire Department and the Lamoille Society for the Promotion of Croquet, 4 high schoolers in hand-me-down blazers. Even though the trophy has never been awarded to a team from outside the county, the locals still erupt in excitement as the perennial winners are knocked out. Nick, Zach, Sam, and Wesley are seniors from Lamoille Union High School, a 40-minute drive from Waterbury.
We've got experience. We've been practicing
the entire week in conditions like this. So.
Wait, you've actually been practicing? Because those people are joking about practicing, but none of them have actually
done. Oh, no, we've been practicing all week.
Oh, yeah, we have a courtyard in the middle of our school, which we have set up a small croquet course and go out during study halls to get a little practice in on the ice.
For the past week, the Lamoille Society for the Promotion of Croquet has been dedicating 3 study halls a day to practice. They got up at 5:30 this morning to get here. So when the crowd starts rumbling that maybe the outsiders shouldn't be allowed to take the trophy home, Tom Beardsley is called over for a ruling.
That's upsetting because we came to win it. And we want that trophy.
We've been talking all morning about how great it's going to look in our school trophy case. So.
All right, we need a ruling. If they win, are they allowed to take the trophy out of the county?
Oh, sure. But we got to have a name and a phone number so next year we can get it back. Just look at these people. Do you want them all trailing you next year at this time?
Complaining loudly that an hour and 45 minutes is unacceptably long for a winter croquet tournament, Beardsley cuts the final game down to a simple poison duel between Lamoille Union and the Junkyard Dogs. After a tentative opening shot by each team, Lamoille goes in for the kill.
Junkyard Dogs are out. Lamoille Union Croquet Society is the winner, 2013.
After reasonable assurances that the trophy will be returned in time for next year's tournament, the Intergalactic Winter Croquet Rotating Trophy is allowed to leave with the kids from Lamoille. There has still been no ruling on whether it would ever be allowed to leave the galaxy. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
All right, hold on, everybody. We have to wave Dan Drack like we always do.
To view Karen's pictures of croquet in the corner of the galaxy known as the Green Mountain State, please visit our website. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Tyler Murray. We had help this week from Mary Gaffney at WBEZ in Chicago. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, or listen to archived shows and stories, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on our Facebook and Twitter pages, username Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from intergalactic croqueteer John Malter, who warns of the presence of croquet zealots.
There are people out here that are professional croquet sharks, and they practice all winter long. You know, you'll see that single light burning in their garage, and you'll hear the croquet mallet going. They're out there.
More evidence that the truth is stranger than fiction. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, LendingTree with the innovative Loan Coach, which provides personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com, the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse, and Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at MiniUSA.com/info. This is NPR.